Now, you will have noticed, if you looked at CourseWorks, that I have posted two different chapter 23, which is today's eruption chapter. The reason for that is that last year's chapter 23, I had carefully arranged all the arrows in the diagrams to point in the right direction. And this year I looked, and of course in Word all of the arrows had discontinued to be arrows, and they were all lines, and I didn't feel like putting all the arrows back in. And so I'm going to ask you to take number 2305 just for the final three pages for the diagrams, because they have the correct arrows on it. And for the rest you use 2306, okay? So, what I'm going to do today, I'm going to talk about the histology of eruption and about some of the mechanisms that have been identified for eruption. Let's first begin with eruptive movements. Developing tooth moves all the time, and so eruptive motion is just one particular part of the movements that we have. Just to show you what can happen at birth, this is the relationship of the primary dentition that is not yet erupted at that time. And you'll notice that there is this kind of thing. There is no dental arch. There is this kind of relationship, and then it goes like this. And then when you're looking at the molar teeth, you notice that they are all kind of arranged in a slanted fashion and partially overlapping. So even before the tooth actually goes into the direct eruptive movements, there are continuously a series of pre-eruptive movements that adjust the position of the developing teeth in the jaw. Now, Dr. Yuan gave you a good working definition of eruption. I will give you my definition. That's perfectly fine, which means that you don't study it by heart, but you have to know what we mean. And what I mean when I talk about eruption, what Dr. Yuan meant when he talked about eruption, is that that is a process. It's not a one-time thing. Eruption really begins when the tooth begins to form its root, and it ends pretty much never. It is a movement that takes place in predominantly vertical direction. As the tooth moves from its site of development, inside the jaw, to a position of functional occlusion in the oral cavity. So that is a lengthy period during which a tooth can move. Eruption begins, as you know, when the crown is complete and the root starts to form. And so when you are looking at a picture like this here, you say, okay, the root has formed from this point in this direction. So the root has been forming for some while. And so one can assume that the eruption that has taken place concurrently is approximately in the same amount. So the amount of movement during eruption probably is about the same as the length of the root that you're seeing right here. And you can see already that there is only a very little distance here between the oral epithelium and the reduced enamel epithelium. Now, I just want you to understand that there are three stages around eruption. First of all, there is a stage during which you really don't have eruption yet. That's the stage before eruption, known as the pre-eruptive stage. And so that is really the stage that encompasses everything until the crown is completed. So you go literally from butt stage until completion of the crown, that is all pre-eruptive stage, okay? So if you see a tooth in the cap stage, you know it's in pre-eruptive stage. It's not yet erupting. It seems self-evident, but every year I'm struck by how many people really have a problem with that. So pre-eruptive stage simply means that it's before eruption. No eruption happening yet. Then, this is in fact the eruptive stage, most of it. The pre-functional eruptive stage, as opposed to what comes in the end, and that's a functional eruptive stage. But pre-functional eruptive stage is everything from the time when the root starts to form until the time when the tooth reaches functional occlusion. Okay, very specifically, from the time root formation begins until the time that the tooth reaches functional occlusion. And at some point during this pre-functional eruptive stage, you have emergence. So emergence is that one event where the tooth literally penetrates the oral mucosa and appears in the oral cavity. Many people say that's eruption. That's not eruption, that is just emergence, which is one event during the process of tooth eruption. You can subdivide the pre-functional eruptive stage into two subsets, and that is pre-emergent eruption and post-emergent eruption. And then finally, we have this odd little thing which is called functional eruptive stage. And that is something that I have to explain to you, and that is that a tooth, when it reaches functional occlusion, does not stop eruptive movement. There is still a little bit of movement that occurs to maintain the occlusal contact of the tooth. And that is simply a situation where you have, first of all, you allow for the wear of the tooth. And so when you allow for the wear of the tooth, tooth wears on the occlusal surface, tooth has to erupt a little bit more to maintain occlusal contact. Also, you can have surrounding teeth that erupt and increase the particular level, the height of the occlusal plane. And when that happens, all of the other teeth that are already in occlusion probably also have to erupt a little bit more to maintain occlusion. You saw a perfect example in the case of the submerged tooth that Dr. Yuan showed. The submerged tooth had reached functional occlusion. All the teeth around them had erupted and had, in fact, increased the height of the occlusal surface. And as a result, the tooth that could not follow that eruption because it was ankylosed to the jaw did not continue to be in occlusal contact. So it didn't have the functional eruptive stage and that was taking place. The functional eruptive stage has active eruption, and that's what you're just seeing. That is just a continuation of the eruptive movement. And we also include in this functional stage something known as passive eruption. Passive eruption we really actually don't like to see. But passive eruption is the events that occur when you expose more of the enamel of the crown and also part of the root as a result of the recession of the gingiva. So when the gingiva undergoes recession and moves in an apical direction, more of the crown is being exposed. We call that passive eruption. There's more exposure of the crown, but the tooth itself doesn't really move in to make that happen. So after the tooth reaches functional occlusion, there are still this active and passive movements during the functional eruptive stage. Okay, not as much as the actual pre-functional eruption, but still something to count with. All right, I just like to show, because they're such pretty pictures, these go along with what Dr. Yuan just showed, the 6-month picture, the completed dentition of deciduous teeth at 4 years. They now are all in occlusion and erupted, and you're seeing, of course, that whole series of permanent teeth all developing in the jaws, and it is quite a crowded event. The mixed dentition, where some deciduous teeth have already appeared in the oral cavity, and where some of the secondary or permanent teeth are still here, especially, of course, the canine and the premolars that you can see in this particular image. That was covered by Dr. Yuan, and we go from here. Now let's look at the histology. The histology of the tooth development is an interesting one in that when you first get the teeth of the second dentition beginning to form, they form in a bony groove common bony groove that they occupy together with the already developing deciduous teeth. And so what you find this groove in the lower jaw, and there's a similar one in the upper jaw, and both teeth are developing in that same space. Okay? Always, of course, the permanent tooth is developing on the on the lingual side or palatal side of the deciduous tooth. And when you get to the point that I illustrated before, when the deciduous incisor was in fact erupting, now what you notice is that we are beginning to separate the bone around these teeth. And what you therefore have is a developing alveolus around the deciduous tooth, and you have a separate space in which the permanent tooth is developing. You might ask yourself, what is this? And if you do, that's a cyst which is developing in the midline of the palate in the area of the incisive canal. So that is nothing to do with teeth. But what you see here, this is the permanent tooth, here is the deciduous tooth, and they are now clearly in two separate spaces. The deciduous tooth in the developing alveolus, the permanent tooth in a separate bony crypt, and that's the term that you're using. A bony crypt is an enclosed space that is usually made of bone in the case of teeth, and if you say bony crypt, yeah, sure. And so you have bone surrounding the individual tooth that is developing there. Now, what happens as we are beginning to erupt the tooth and we're getting to the pre-emergent eruption? What you're seeing is as the tooth is moving in this direction, you see here this is the space that was occupied by the enamel. The enamel is no longer there. It is lost during demineralization. So this is dentin. And what you're seeing here on the outside is the REE. So the REE covers the crown of the tooth. And as the tooth is moving in this direction, this REE begins to approach the oral epithelium. Okay, later on this week, we will talk about oral epithelium, but just notice it right here now. And so what has to happen, and just make this as a marker, all of this soft tissue has to be removed. Has to be removed in order for the tooth to move in the direction of the oral epithelium. I see here a slightly later stage. In the case of the deciduous teeth, there is always a lot of blood vessels here. These are all blood vessels. What you find is this particular tissue has a name. We actually call it the operculum, which just meaning is a soft tissue cover over the tooth. It still has to be removed. But you see clearly that the REE, which is here, and the oral epithelium now are very close together. And then there comes a moment when the two epithelia fuse. And when the two epithelia fuse, as you see here, and there is no longer a connective tissue that supports the oral epithelium, this tissue now is doomed. Okay? There is no way that you can have epithelium continue to live without the support of the connective tissue below it. So once the two epithelia are fused in this area, there will be an opening. And that opening will gradually be wider, and as it becomes wider, the tooth emerges into the oral cavity. Look again, you have some bone here, not a whole lot yet. There's some bone here for the developing alveolus. And again, notice that this bony crypt is pretty much completely surrounding that permanent tooth. Now we get to the post-emergent eruption. And the thing now is that at this stage here, you are very close to functional occlusion already. And in the picture next here, you are in functional occlusion. So this, because what you're seeing here now, the root has been pretty much completed. So when the root is completed, that is well after functional occlusion. Okay? And what you're noticing now, I hope, is the fact that at this point you have perhaps one half to two thirds of the route completed, not more than that. And the opening of the root canal is quite wide. So this is when the tooth first comes into occlusion. That is the situation. You have a very short root. It's by no means the full length is there yet. And you have a very wide opening. You can't even call it an apical foramen, because an apical foramen is by nature and by the definition a contracted space. And you may, meanwhile, you notice that this tooth, this permanent tooth, is beginning to have maturation of the enamel. And you see that over here you have already pretty much enamel space. And in this next picture here, the enamel is nearly completed, with the exception, there's a little bit here where you still have enamel matrix, but it's just in the cervical region. By and large, the enamel has been completed here, and this tooth will soon become ready for eruption. I need to talk to you for a moment about an unusual structure, and that is known as a group of openings in the bone that are known as the gubernacular foramina. What are those? Well, here you notice them. Just look here, that's one. There's look here, there's another. There's one here. The other ones are not quite so well visible, but there are at least five that are clearly visible. The gubernacular foramina are the openings through which the successional dental lamina passes. And so in the case of the when you have successional teeth, the permanent dentition developing there, and you look at a bony specimen of a very young child, clearly, you will see these openings, these foramina, which are right on the palatal or on the labial side of the deciduous teeth. Now, that has to do with the outgrowth of the dental lamina. So you remember each of these deciduous tooth has a permanent or successional lamina that forms on the palatal or lingual site of the deciduous teeth. And so the foramina, the gubernacular foramina, are found on the palatal or lingual site. But you don't find the foramina for the permanent teeth. Now, why is that? Because the dental lamina for the permanent teeth does not grow down from the oral epithelium. It grows posteriorly from the existing dental lamina underneath the oral epithelium. So this is the oral epithelium, and the lamina that gives rise to the permanent molars actually grows below, it kind of tunnels below the oral epithelium. And so you can find probably little openings between dental alveolus of the second deciduous molar and the bony crypt of the first permanent molar. That you can see, but you cannot see the gubernacular foramina. How long does the dental lamina really exist? Well, pretty much from the sixth week of prenatal life until such time when your third molar gets ready to erupt. So dental lamina is a structure that lasts for a long, long time, in one way or another. So the gubernacular foramen then, any gubernacular foramen, consists of the following. It consists of the remnants of the successional lamina and the surrounding connective tissue. Okay? And here you see the wall, the bony opening of a gubernacular foramen. This is a very unusual section. You can just see it. And here you see it again. Here is a gubernacular foramen in this section, right on the lingual side of the deciduous tooth that is in function here. Now, the gubernacular foramen will come back to us in a moment, but right now let's just continue on with the story. Okay, now we are purely in descriptive terms. So now you're seeing here the permanent tooth, and the permanent tooth is just about done with the formation of the crown, and it is beginning to noodle up to the root of the deciduous tooth. And what you're beginning to see now for the first time, this is a movement that's not really an eruptive movement yet, but you notice that what has happened is that the bony wall that separates those two structures has disappeared in this area. There's an opening now. And you also may notice that there is this part of the root of that deciduous tooth is beginning to show evidence of loss of material. That is beginning to show resorption. And that is one of the big differences between the eruption of the primary dentition and the eruption of the secondary dentition or permanent dentition. Because the eruption of the primary dentition really only involves removal of soft tissues with a little bit of overhang of bone, but that's relatively minor. So it is mostly removal of soft tissues in the case of primary tooth eruption. In the case of the permanent or secondary tooth eruption, what you are going to have to do is remove hard tissues, bone, cementum, dentin of the primary tooth, and then you are going to have to also remove some soft connective tissue. So it's a little bit more complicated when you're talking about the resorption and the eruption of the permanent tooth. And so what you're getting is an interesting situation. You have to start thinking about the resorption of dental tissues. I have shown it to you already in some of the small group sessions. Now we're getting to it officially. And what you find is that this is dentin, and that is a little bit of cementum here. And what you begin to see is, if you're looking here, there's a little cell here, a little cell there, and one more, and one more, starting out as mononuclear cells. And they have a unique histochemical profile. That means that they are tartrate-resistant acid phosphatase cells. Now, that, for those of you who read the literature on osteoclasts, is a typical characteristic of osteoclasts. Osteoclasts have the ability to have an acid phosphatase in the cell that resists tartrate treatment. And so that's how you can tell an osteoclast, okay, histochemically. And so what you find is that these cells at a subsequent stage begin to look like this, and finally they look like the typical characteristic cells that are osteoclasts. We call them odontoclasts. There is some disagreement among people that look at these cells. They say they're odontoclasts, they're a little different from osteoclasts. I must tell you, I'm not 100% convinced, but I just feel that I have to tell you that some people think they are different cells. They are, for all intents and purposes, multinucleated osteoclast-like cells that are going to resorb the cementum, and they're going to resorb the dentin. And when you are looking at the effect of that, you're seeing here an area where you have very active resorption, and that active resorption at this stage produces the typical lacunae. We can call them Howship's lacunae if they want. I don't think Howship ever looked at teeth, but that's not neither here nor there. The point is there are resorption lacunae and a host of multinucleated cells that are very osteoclast-like. And these cells, for periods of time, can be very aggressive in the resorption of the root surface. And this is a very aggressive period. You will agree with me when you see this many osteoclasts, it's big time resorption. Okay? But there are other times when there is a rest period and actually a repair period. And the repair period is frequently as a result of a backing off of the permanent tooth. The permanent tooth does not continue to push, and cause this continuous resorption. A permanent tooth can move a little bit back again. And when it moves back again, you get repair. First you get acellular, afibrous cementum, that's very, very strange stuff, and followed by what you really know, cellular intrinsic fiber cementum, which is much more what you know. And what you get is this. So you can have a resorption lacuna, a series of them, in the root of the primary tooth, of the deciduous tooth, and then you get repair of composed of cellular intrinsic fiber cementum that actually repairs it for a while. And so what you see clinically, when you have a child that has a deciduous tooth which is about to be shed or exfoliated, there are periods of time when that tooth is very loose, flapping in the breeze. And then there are times when the tooth all of a sudden is fixed again. Very nice, functioning nicely, thank you very much, child has no problem there at all. And then the child will come back for a follow-up visit a couple of weeks later, all flapping in the breeze again. Comes back again, it's fixed again. Okay? And so it's very interesting to follow it up clinically see that happening. Ultimately, however, the resorption wins, okay? So each time you get a little bit more resorption, you each time may find some more repair, but there is always, at some point, the resorption will win. And here what you're seeing now is, this is crown dentin, and it's not quite crown dentin, it's upper root. Let me say upper root, because there is actually still a little bit of a EFC here. Now that you know what to look for. And what you're seeing here is, now actually the resorption has become, horizontal. That is, you're beginning to separate the roots from the crown at this point. And there is repair, and it is CIFC here. And there is actually a little bit of additional repair that is AEFC. So that is remarkable, that much repair actually occurred. And actually the tooth became fixed again even at this last stage of exfoliation. So you have this repair, resorption, resorption ultimately wins. And so what you find is that in this case here, one half of the root has pretty much disappeared. What you're having here, all of the dentin on this side is gone, there's a little bit here left. This is in the pulp now. You are in the pulp. This dentin, of course, is fine. That would be on the labial side. But what you're now noticing, and that is something that you clearly are beginning to recognize, what's happening in the pulp? Okay, we have looked at the pulp. We have looked at calcified bodies in the pulp. What kind of calcified bodies are those, folks? Okay. Yeah. Cementicles in the pulp, sure. Okay. Let's try again. There are three types of calcifications. Not pulp stones. Huh? Dystrophic calcifications. You have all of these little noodles here. That's dystrophic calcification, people. Typical example of dystrophic calcification of the dental pulp in a tooth that is about to be shed. Okay. Now, when the pulp is invaded, things are happening. I mean, the pulp is now really under attack. And you find now that the odontoblasts are actually going to be moved away a little bit. This is an odontoblast, but it's kind of moved out of the way. And what you find here is... here is a typical situation where you have a dendritic cell. This is a dendritic cell. Okay? And it's beginning to sample what's coming on in the tubules. Things are not the way they ought to be. And what you're seeing here is that as the whole process begins to accelerate, you get antigen-presenting cells that are going to sample what is coming from the outside. Things are... messages are coming in, and you find that there's an increase in immunocompetent cells. You actually get an increase in the lymphocytes. Okay, lymphocytes are increasing big time. And you have activation of T lymphocytes to actually mount an immunodefense response. And the T lymphocytes also are able to give messages for further resorption, to activate osteoclasts. The point is that the pulp, until the last moment, really is valiantly trying to protect itself and to protect the tissues that are further upstream by producing an immunodefense response. It's useless because ultimately the tooth is going to be exfoliated, but there is actually still a lot of activity going on. Now what's happening is, and that's the final stage, it really happens, the final stage. What you're beginning out with is these red cells are the osteoclast-like cells. You have pretty much resorbed most of the root away. That was that picture I showed you before, that with the horizontal resorption surface. And now what's going to happen is you're beginning to invade the actual crown dentin. And not only the actual crown dentin, if you look closely, you begin to see osteoclasts that are going to replace the odontoblasts. And so they are going to, you're not only going to find the osteoclasts on the root surface, what used to be the root surface of the tooth, but you're also going to find osteoclasts actually lining the pulpal surface of the dentin and beginning to resorb there. And this is what you're seeing here, beginning to resorb there. And if the tooth continues to be present in the mouth, beyond that, you will actually see that the resorption goes into the enamel. Enamel can be resorbed at this point. And if you have, for example, a class 1 restoration, you may find that all of the dental tissues around the floor of that restoration have actually been removed and the restoration kind of hangs out free. This is what you find. Here is a typical example of osteoclasts lining the dentin surface. And there's still predentin here. The predentin is still here, but clearly the osteoclasts are beginning to attack that. Now, there comes a moment that things cannot not continue on for a while. What you find is that when this tooth gets so short that it gets to, that this boundary gets to lie above the oral mucosa actually, that you started here, begins to grow in. And as it grows in, it begins to separate the pulp tissue from the underlying connective tissue. And now what happens is, at this point here, that has happened here, the oral mucosa has grown in here, and the last little bit of soft connective tissue that held this tooth in place is right here. All the rest, now you have actually epithelium that is separating the tooth from the underlying connective tissue, and you just have that little attachment. I don't know whether you remember the feeling of a tooth that was about to fall out. You played with it. You kept pushing it. You kept pushing it back and forth, driving everybody crazy. Okay? And there was a point when you felt like taking it out because it just irritated the hell out of you. But this is the point where you literally have to do very little to remove that tooth. Okay? This is a tooth that has been shed. And here are all the resorption lacunae on this side. They are already separated from the underlying connective tissue. Here is a little bit of connective tissue still left, but it's clear that it is just about gone. All right, so we have now removed the deciduous tooth, and now we are going to look at the bony alveolus. And the bony alveolus that you're seeing here, diagrammatically I have four pictures, rather classical pictures showing this event happening. This is what we start out with a common groove. Okay, this is the common groove, and deciduous and permanent teeth were developing together in the same groove. Then there came the eruption, and now at that point there was a bony crypt here, and an alveolus here. And at this point you have the bony crypt with the gubernacular canal right here. So again, it's bony crypt and alveolus. And now the tooth is erupting in this direction and occupying most of what was previously occupied by the deciduous tooth. So as the permanent tooth is moving into this area of the alveolus, it actually it uses part of the alveolus that belonged to the predecessor. But it has to, of course, remodel a little bit. It's bigger in most cases, and so bone has to be remodeled all around it, and you get some removal of old bone tissue, and that's what you're seeing here. So now here is the permanent tooth in place. Just one quick discussion here. This, the histology of the bony crypt. What kind of histology would you expect it to be? Is it the same as an alveolus, or is it different? Same? Here's a vote for the same. Puria is always dangerous. Okay, anybody say it's different? Okay, Puria, you are in outvoted. Because I say no. Okay. My vote counts double. Okay. The thing is that the alveolus of a tooth has bundle bone, remember, that allows for the attachment of Sharpie's fibers. And there are no periodontal ligament fibers yet when the permanent tooth sits in its bony crypt. So the permanent tooth, the bony crypt there, is just compact lamellar bone. It does not have bundle bone. So that's the difference. Okay, Dr. Yuan showed you these pictures here and showed you how you have the different movements from what originally was a lingual position to a position where the teeth are more stacked on top of each other as they are, as the deciduous teeth are replaced. And this is the picture. This is a 3D reconstruction from my friend Professor Owe, who actually showed a beautiful picture of a developing tooth here, the first permanent molar, first permanent premolar, with the deciduous molar roots kind of forming a little basket around it. And yes, when Dr. Yuan said that you can extract first deciduous molar and accidentally remove a first permanent molar, I've seen it happen. I've seen some people doing just that, and I'm looking at it, oh my God. Okay, what do? Pop it back in. Trust me, it may work. Okay. That's what he did. The tooth eventually erupted, so hey. Okay. Now, here's the question, people. What are the mechanisms of eruption of teeth? That's a very big question, and it is one that we only have a partial answer to. So let's just look at what happens and what makes a tooth erupt. First of all, this is a very important point to make. When a tooth is erupting, it has two very distinct poles. There is an occlusal end to the tooth and there is an apical end. And at the occlusal end, all the activities that you see are destructive, removal of tissues, while at the apical end, the activities are proliferative. Growth of a root, growth of a periodontal ligament, growth of anything that you can see. So the destructive activities are involved in the establishment of an eruption path, and that occurs, you have some bone resorption, breakdown of soft tissues in deciduous dentition, and as I mentioned before, you have, when the permanent successor is erupting, you have breakdown of bone and breakdown of the deciduous roots of the permanent, when the tooth is, the permanent tooth is erupting, so it is, of course, the deciduous roots that are the predecessor's roots. So there is this important difference between the two sides of an erupting tooth. What has to be done? And this is part of the diagrams that I indicate to you. There are two essential parts to the eruption of a tooth. One is that you have to clear the eruption pathway. And if you don't, the tooth, in fact, does not erupt. For example, individuals who are having a pathology in that they cannot resorb bone tissue will have problems with the eruption of teeth. Okay, so the pathway has to be cleared, And then the second thing that you have to have is a propelling force that generates the eruptive movements of the tooth. Those two, and those two together only, you cannot have one in one part of it and not the other, between them cause the eruption of the teeth. Now, we know a little bit more about this one, the clearing of the eruption pathway, than about this one. There's a lot of question here. We know what it takes to remove mineralized tissues in the pathway, and we know what it takes to remove removal of soft tissues in the pathway. And what we find is that the component that is most important for both of these activities is the reduced enamel epithelium. Okay? So the reduced enamel epithelium that was so busy in the shaping of the tooth, that was so busy in inducing odontoblast and then forming enamel, that reduced enamel epithelium now has a role in the eruption of the tooth. First of all, they do it by directly producing collagenase and other proteolytic enzymes, and in doing so, they break down the connective tissues and, of course, secondarily the epithelium in the eruption pathway. So the soft tissues are broken down directly by the reduced enamel epithelial cells with the assistance of the coronal dental sac cells. So that is easy enough. The mineralized tissues have a little bit more of a complication, but again, it's the REE cells that produce the signals. First, they secrete interleukin, which enhances the formation of the receptors for parathyroid hormone-related protein, both on the bone cells and on the coronal sac cells. Okay? Then the second thing that they're doing, they actually secrete parathyroid hormone-related protein, which then binds to the receptors, which they increase by producing interleukin-1-alpha. So this is strictly REE cells. The first message to come and the first signals to come are coming from the REE cells. Now, secondarily, once the REE cells have done their job, now the coronal dental sac cells, which have been stimulated by the parathyroid hormone-related protein, now begin to make the necessary messages to produce the osteoclast formation, the mononuclear cell proteins and the colony stimulating factor 1 for first recruiting the mononuclear cells and then helping them to form osteoclast development. And then the second thing, again, under the influence of the REE cells, which stimulated the receptors on the bone cells now tone down the secretion of the osteoprotegerin, and they start increasing rankle, which now leads to the resorption of bone tissue. So there are these different messages that, in the end, all work together to lead to the resorption of the hard tissues. The diagrams that I produced in your chapter are probably way too complicated. These are the primary things that you have to know. Okay, so stick with what I summarized here, and don't try to get a full sense of all of the events that have to happen. Although, if you want to understand the complexity of the events, that is a good place to start. I also included in this chapter 23 my own list of the events in the development of primary and secondary dentition. We all kind of do it. We get the best sources, we think. And so Dr. Yuan has his list, and I have my list. They're pretty close together, but there are differences. So what you're doing is, when you get to be in practice, you take all these lists and stick them all up, and then you take the list that works best for the patient that sits in your chair at that moment. Okay, theories of eruption. What have we got? We have lots of theories of eruption. Most of them have been discredited, but there are still some around. Because now we are going to go to the other part of the eruption, and that is the propelling force that makes the tooth erupt. We have dealt with the removal of the tissues. We know a lot about this. The removal of the tissues has been studied in great detail in the last few years, and we know really a lot about it. But what we don't know is what provides that propelling force for the tooth to erupt. We have some theories of eruption, and let's just discredit them right now. The pull of the gubernacular cord, that will be discredited. I'll show you a good picture of it. The other one is, it's a doozy, the cushioned hammock ligament. I'll show you an example of what that means. Formation of bone in the fundus of the alveolus, also a total cracker. But then there are other theories that have not been so much discredited. We really are still working on it. One is the contraction of the maturing periodontal ligament fibers, possibly. One is contractile filaments in the PDL fibroblasts. Movement of the PDL fibroblast. Oh, this one is a... Remove this one. Well, no, you can still keep it. That is the rocket-like action of the expanding dental papilla. The dental papilla does increase in volume, and it is theoretically possible that it produces a counterforce that actually leads to the eruption of the tooth. But all right. And then there is the local vascular hydrostatic pressure. Let's look at some of these things. Here's the gubernacular cord. The gubernacular cord, I've just shown to you, really consists of a remnant of dental lamina surrounded by some connective tissue. And people were thinking that it actually pulled out the tooth in this direction. It's fine, except it doesn't go that way. Actually, the tooth goes according to this black arrow. And so the eruption by the pull of the gubernacular cord really is not a realistic thing, and I don't remember anybody in recent years that still thinks that way, okay? So the gubernacular cord, I say, minus, nothing happening here. The cushioned hammock ligament, another one that has been discredited. And why would people think that? Now, if you look at a developing tooth, this is during root formation. Remember, this tooth has hers, and when a tooth has hers, it is forming a root, and when it forms a root, it is erupting, right? And so what you're seeing here is fibers, and the fibers are running in this direction. Now, the fibers are actually going all the way around the apical end of the developing tooth. And there are actually wide open spaces in here. Lots of fluid is present in this area. And so when you have a structure like this, the idea was, it was hanging in here, attached to one bone here and then attached to the other bone. And so this is kind of a ligament, a hammock. And if you have the expansion of the dental papilla, that pushes against that hammock ligament, and so the tooth has to move in the opposite direction. Now, the idea was an interesting one, except the fact that this ligament was really a remnant of the dental sac. And the dental sac goes parallel to the root. It doesn't insert into the bone. That is definitely not the case. And so the cushioned hammock ligament, that whole idea is, again, out of the window. And then there is the other one. And this is an interesting one people also think about. As you know, I have consistently stressed the fact that the amount of root that is formed equals the amount of eruption of the tooth. And when you have that, presumably the location of the growing tip of the root pretty much stays the same. But sometimes there are periods of time when the tooth actually erupts a little faster than the root forms. And when that happens, the space behind it is actually filled with these little bits of spongy bone tissue. Very quick filling in after the tooth moves out. Essentially, we don't like to have just loose connective tissue in the fundus of the alveolus. Fundus means just the bottom part. And so some little bone forms just to fill the space. the opposite can happen too. So when you see this, tooth erupts faster than root grows. Okay, this is what happens here. And so what you have then is a little filling of bone tissue. The opposite happens when the root grows faster than the eruption of the tooth is taking place. And when that happens, so when root grows faster, what happens then? You get resorption here. So resorption apically. Okay, so resorption of the bone in this area. So you can look at the fundus of the alveolus. If you see resorption of the bone in the fundus, the root temporarily grew a little faster than the rate of eruption. When the opposite occurs, the root erupts faster than the root is growing. Sorry, the tooth is erupting faster than the root is growing. Then you get filling in of bone tissue. So that is just reflecting the differential between root growth and eruption. So, if you have bone in the fundus, that is all it means. Some people thought that the bone actually was forming and pushed the tooth out. That is so unlike bone tissue that it is almost to laugh. Okay? So, bone tissue never generates that kind of force. It always forms secondarily in response to the ability to form because of space. Blood flow. How does blood flow affect eruption? Blood flow actually can affect eruption. The average eruption of human teeth is happening at a fast rate of, it's kind of minimal, 2 micrometers per hour. And most of that occurs during the daytime. At nighttime, the tooth gets pushed in a little bit. Oh, no, sorry, it happens during nighttime. During the daytime, the tooth gets pushed in a little bit as a result of function. And what you find is that if you increase blood flow in the area, you actually increase also the eruption. So that is something that in this case here, there was experimentally blood flow was increased and the eruption increased. There are other small cyclic variations of eruption that are known as Tentrini cycles. I don't want to go into that too far. That's a little bit too much. But there is some relationship between the blood flow and the rate of eruption of human teeth. So, what is the mechanism of eruption? And there are many theories. None is definitively proven at this time. Most likely, and that is something that we can say, we have to look for it at the proliferative end, the proliferative apical end of the erupting tooth. I told you an eruptive tooth has a destructive end on the coronal side and a proliferative end on the apical side. And the proliferative end most likely produces the propelling force for eruption. This proliferation may be in response to epidermal growth factor, and that is something that you do have to know about. We know that when you give an animal additional epidermal growth factor, you actually increase the eruption of the tooth. All right, that is all I have to say. We'll see you tomorrow, and please look at the coursework, the assignment, and make up your mind what you want to work on.